somewhere I read, of the freedom of speech.
Et qui défendait la liberté d'expression.
The moment you limit free speech, it's not free speech.
Somebody will say, oh, freedom of speech, freedom of speech. These are foolish people.
Welcome to Clear and Present Danger, a history of free speech by Jakub Mshangama.
Clear and Present Danger relies on the generous support of FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, Fridor, and the Politiken Foundation.
Episode 13, Expert Opinion, Jonathan Haidt. Welcome to a very special episode. Not only is it the second expert opinion in a row, but my guest is also someone I'm particularly thrilled to have on the show. None other than Jonathan Haidt, who just this week published The Coddling of the American Mind, How Good Intentions and Bad Ideas Are Setting Up a Generation for Failure, co-authored with FIRE's Greg Lukianov, and already among Amazon's top 20 best-selling books. I highly recommend it, but don't just take my word for it. The book has earned great reviews, including in the New York Times. Today's episode will deviate from the general timeline of the podcast by focusing on free speech at American campuses, which is one of the topics discussed in The Coddling of the American Mind. But in the last part of the interview, we try to link some of the present challenges to free speech with older controversies in order to determine whether some of the psychological mechanisms driving calls for censorship today are the same that drove calls for censorship in antiquity, the Middle Ages, the Reformation, and so on. Jonathan Haidt is the Thomas Cooley Professor of Ethical Leadership at NYU's Stern School of Business. Haidt is a social psychologist and the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Righteous Mind, and as mentioned, fresh off the press, The Coddling of the American Mind, co-authored with FIRE's Greg Lukianov. Among a dizzying range of activities, Jonathan Haidt is also the co-founder of Heterodox Academy, a large and growing group of professors and students who disagree on many things, but are united in their mission to increase viewpoint diversity at American universities. Professor Haidt, thank you so much for coming on the show, and congratulations to you and Greg on publishing The Coddling of the American Mind, which has earned very fine reviews indeed.
Thanks so much, Jacob. Thanks for having me on.
So this podcast is about the history of free speech, and I've only made it to the 17th century so far. But in today's episode, I hope we can ignore the laws of nature and travel a bit back and forth in time. And I'd like to begin in the present. Can you describe the development and trends that prompted you to first write an article in The Atlantic and then revise and expand it into a book?
Certainly. Very happy to do so. So the story of the book is that Greg Lukianov, who is the president of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, has been fighting encroachments on students' free speech, all these efforts that universities make to control students' speech, usually to protect themselves from liability. They create free speech zones, all sorts of things like that. So Greg had been working at FIRE for about 12 years. And he started suddenly seeing that the encroachments on speech were not coming from administrators. Beginning in the 2013 to 2014 academic year, for the first time, he started seeing students themselves asking for protections from words, asking that other people's words or books be limited. And this really took him by surprise. And then it turned out that the way students were often talking about this, it reminded him of the very cognitive distortions that he had learned not to do in his therapy for depression. Greg had a very bad depression episode in 2007. He thinks that cognitive behavioral therapy saved his life. And you learn not to catastrophize, not to do black and white thinking, not to do emotional reasoning. And suddenly, around 2014, Greg started seeing that the justifications for limiting speech were things like catastrophizing. Students saying, oh, if this book is assigned, if we're not warned about its content, it will traumatize some students. So this was new. And Greg came to talk to me about it because I'm a psychologist, I'm a social psychologist, and I'd written a book called The Happiness Hypothesis that Greg had read. And when Greg told me his idea that something strange was happening on campus with these new ideas about fragility, I jumped at the chance to work with him because I had just begun to see similar things too. This is 2014. And this is right when the first articles are written about requests for trigger warnings. Nobody had really heard of these before 2014. And then also all this talk about microaggressions and safe spaces, all of this comes in around 2014 to 2015. So that's what prompted us to write the article. The article in The Atlantic was published in August of 2015, and a lot of people thought that we were cherry-picking, we were catastrophizing, we were just blowing up a few anecdotes from a few schools. But this was before all the big blow-ups in the fall of 2015. So Halloween is always a difficult time on campus nowadays because it's a time when people are afraid that others will do something offensive. So the big blow-ups happened after the Yale episode, the Yale Halloween episode with Nicholas and Erica Christakis, and that was November 2015. So in the year after we wrote our book, things really kind of blew up on a lot of campuses, and that's what led us to write. So we wrote the article in 2015. That's what led us to write the book, is that we thought we basically had said all we had to say, but then all this stuff happened, and it became clear the problem is much bigger and more interesting than we had thought. So the book is about how a new culture, a new moral culture is emerging. It's not found on most campuses. I mean, there's 4,500 colleges in America, and most of them, you know, they're commuter schools, they're non-selective schools, they're places where people have lives outside of school. So at most schools, this isn't happening. But at the elite schools, especially in the Northeast and the West Coast, there's a new culture, and it is chilling speech for many people, for professors and students. That's what the book is about, where this came from, why it's bad for students themselves, and what we can do to improve the speech climate on campus.
You alluded to it yourself, but this idea that there's a free speech crisis, notwithstanding what happened at Yale and other places, that has been contested by a number of critics who argue that American students overwhelmingly support the idea of free speech and that the data showing negative trends lack robustness. So are you and Greg guilty of committing one of the very sins you charge students with, namely catastrophizing by negative filtering information?
Now, that's a great question because we're human and we're certainly prone to all the same biases and problems that we're writing about. And it is undoubtedly true that there is a moral panic on the right about free speech where people do catastrophize. They're motivated by their political desires to blow things up and present it as though college students have lost their minds and all colleges have become bastions of liberal ideology. So yes, there's the risk of that. And there are many people who do that. We don't. In our book, we make it clear that what's happening here is a new dynamic. It's not that students have changed so much. It's that they, for a variety of reasons that I hope we'll get into, the dynamics of speaking up and being called out are new. So it's not that students have lost their minds. It's that they've been put into an insane social media environment in the middle of a raging culture war at a time when universities are increasingly corporate, and they are a generation for whom they were raised in very overprotected ways. For the best of intentions, they were not given much time outside. They were not given much chance to practice independence. So our argument is not that students have turned against free speech. It's that six or seven different threads have conspired so that people are more afraid to speak, at least on elite college campuses. Let me just address you mentioned the skeptics, these various skeptics. In like, I think it was February or March, there were about six different essays asserting that there is no free speech crisis on campus. And one, I think Matt Iglesias of Vox, what did he title his essay? It was like, "Everything we think about the political correctness debate is wrong." Mm-hmm. Now, this debate, it shows exactly why free speech is so helpful, because, you know, we debated things, the challenge forced us to dig into the data, and I think we all came away with a much better sense of what the facts are. So the facts that that the critics pointed to was, if you look at the GSS, that is the General Social Survey, a political scientist in Canada named Jeff Sachs had analyzed this shown that... that's what he was drawing on another guy, Justin Murphy, who looked at it earlier, that if you look at the free speech questions, there's no sign of a dip. In fact, if anything, over time, people get more supportive of free speech. And so that's the basis of the skepticism, you know, show us the data. And so Sean Stevens, who's the research director at Heterodox Academy, he and I dug into the data and we found a number of things. First, the GSS it doesn't have data on iGen. That is the data that we're
the internet generation.
Yeah, the internet generation or Gen Z, basically kids born after 1995. So if you say, oh, the millennials have lost their minds, show us the data. No, they haven't lost their minds. Well, right, the GSS data on the millennials show that they are very tolerant of free, not tolerant, they strongly value free speech, and there's no sign that they're any different. But our whole argument is that this starts with kids born in 1995 and after, because you don't see any of this stuff until 2013, 2014, and it only spreads nationally in 2015. So the millennials are out of college by then, or they're the last ones are leaving. So when we dug into the data, we showed that the millennials are no different, but the little bit of data in the GSS for iGen, they only have a few hundred people in the last data set, that actually does show a dip. Furthermore, the way that the GSS measures this is, how would you feel about allowing a homosexual to speak or a communist? Because these questions were made up in the 1970s, mm-hmm. and those were the issues back. So yeah, every generation is more tolerant of homosexuals and communists speaking, because now it's a ridiculous question. Of course they should speak. Why wouldn't they? So what we pointed out is that if you use the method of asking people about what's a group that you hate, now, how would you feel about them speaking? Then you find no improvement and you find some signs of a dip, that the youngest generation is more willing to suppress their speech. So there's a lot more that we can say, but if listeners will Google my name, Haidt, H-A-I-D-T, and then The Skeptics Are Wrong, Part 2, you'll find our very extensive blog post where we go through all of the nationally representative data in great detail, and we show that if you just look at iGen, what you find is, yes, in the abstract, they still support free speech, but the instant you pit it against anything about diversity and inclusion, then they're much more likely to go with diversity and inclusion. So it's not that they've lost their minds. It's just that they have a different moral system, and it's really focused on diversity and inclusion, which is a good thing in many ways, but it ends up doing things that change the climate on campus so that people are afraid to speak.
All right, let's present some of the ideas that you argue might be driving this development. You present three bad ideas or untruths that you refer to throughout the book. Can you describe these untruths and why they're bad for free speech and academic freedom in particular?
Sure. So my first book is called The Happiness Hypothesis, Finding Modern Truth in Ancient Wisdom. And I reviewed, I was teaching a psychology class at the University of Virginia at the time, and I reviewed all of the claims I could find from all ancient sources about psychology. And I said, which ones stand the test of time? And one of the best, one that you find everywhere, pretty much, is the idea of anti-fragility. So actually, I think I have a couple of quotes here from that. Mencius, the Chinese philosopher Mencius, says, when heaven is about to confer a great responsibility on any man, it will exercise his mind with suffering, subject his sinews and bones to hard work, etc., etc., so as to stimulate his mind, harden his nature, and improve wherever he is incompetent. So this is a great truth that, as Nietzsche put it, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. What Greg began to see in 2014 is students saying, if I'm exposed to somebody that I find hateful, if somebody comes to speak on my campus that I strongly disagree with, someone who criticizes my most cherished beliefs, this will damage me and my friends. This will traumatize people. This will be harmful. And so this is the exact opposite of ancient wisdom. And so the principle that we coined, the book is based on these three great untruths. Great untruth number one is, what doesn't kill you makes you weaker. And that's the justification for saying, hey, we need trigger warnings so that people can choose to avoid works that will trigger them. Well, safe spaces are not very common, but the very idea that an academic classroom should in any way be a safe space where people don't have to worry that their ideas will be criticized or their values will be questioned, these ideas are antithetical to what we need to do in an institution of higher learning. Obviously, there should be no insults. There should be real checks on hostility. But if you're discussing ideas and someone finds a claim that a fellow student makes to be upsetting or offensive, And you say, well, therefore, you can't make it. And even more so, I can report you. There are numbers on the wall in every bathroom at NYU, as at many schools, to report to the bias response team. If someone says something in class, if I, as a professor, say anything in class that someone finds offensive, they can report me anonymously. Boy, does this chill speech. I will not say anything provocative anymore. I can talk provocative to you because you can't report me. But I will, you know, if I'm on the NYU campus, I won't say anything that could lead to a student being offended.
So I guess that also affects everything from humor to just challenging students and their beliefs, because something can be taken out of context and understood differently by different persons.
That's right. So in 2014, 2015, when Greg and I were reviewing what was going on campuses, and again, at the time, it was not most campuses, it was a minority, but like half the stories were about jokes. Half the stories where a professor said something and, you know, he made a joke that referenced, you know, a gun or something like that, or, you know, just shoot me, or, that wasn't one, but things like that, just some joke. And this got blown up into an episode that in some cases led to the professor being fired.
So that was the first untruth. What are the other two?
So great untruth number two is always trust your feelings. And so this is probably the greatest of all the great truths. This is the one you find in every culture that leaves us any philosophical reflection. So here's Epictetus. What really frightens and dismays us is not external events themselves, but the way in which we think about them. It is not things that disturb us, but our interpretation of their significance. And here's Buddha. Our life is the creation of our mind. And here's Shakespeare, here's Hamlet. There is nothing either good or bad, but thinking makes it so. Now that is CBT in a nutshell, that you have a choice how to interpret things. Somebody says something that you take offense to, well, think about it. First, are you sure that the person even meant what you think they did? And second, even if they meant what you think they did, do you want to make your nervous system be controlled by someone else? Do you want to get upset by this? Or is there some other response? So this is what CBT does. It teaches you to choose your response, choose a more constructive response. And what Greg began to see on campus is that students were increasingly told, you have your experience, no one can question that. And your experience it tells you how the world is, and no one can question that. And to say in a university that no one can, that you have a pipeline to truth and no one can question it, that makes it almost impossible to do our work. We have to be able to challenge each other. We have to be able to task others with providing evidence for their claims. And if we encourage what's called emotional reasoning in CBT, if we encourage that, again, it's hard to do our work, and we're doing the students no favors. Greg's initial insight was these thought patterns around speech are actually likely to make students more anxious and depressed. That's exactly why you challenge emotional reasoning in CBT.
Great. And the last one of these untruths?
And the third one, this is, I think, the most pernicious. It's the one that I've spent the last 10 years really working on. We call it the untruth of us versus them. The idea that life is a battle between good people and evil people. My second book was called The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. And it's all about how we evolved as tribal creatures. We evolved for war, I believe. We are really, really good at doing us versus them. We're good at making peace too. We're good at trading with groups far away. So we can turn up the tribalism and we can shut it off. We're very good at resolving conflicts as well. And so if you are going to create a diverse environment on campus, and pretty much every university I know of is committed to diversity. So if we're going to reach out and actively recruit and try to create a lot of racial diversity, obviously gender diversity, sexual orientation, sexual identities, if we're going to do all this, the potential for misunderstanding, which is always there in any group, the potential becomes enormously greater, especially with international diversity. If you're bringing in students from all over the world who don't know American norms, we have very, very fine norms, or fine meaning, you know, like micro specific norms about how to talk about sexual orientation and race and gender. So if you have a lot of international diversity, it's guaranteed that every single day there will be dozens and dozens of times when someone says something that someone else takes offense to. They might have meant hostility by it, but usually I think they don't. It's a misunderstanding. But if you teach students to see social life as a battle between good and evil, and you teach them to see some groups as good and some as evil, and the boundaries of those are given by privilege, let's say, by whichever groups have privilege, those are the bad groups. So if we're teaching students a particular form of identity politics that encourages them to see binary dimensions, this is as contrary to CBT as could be. It's as contrary to ancient wisdom as could be. And it's as contrary to the goal of creating a successful, diverse community as could be. So what we do in the book is we say identity politics is necessary. You have politics. You have people organizing by all kinds of interest groups. Why shouldn't people organize by race or gender or sexual identities? So there's nothing wrong with that. But if you do it by uniting against a common enemy, that is divisive. That is likely to just strengthen the anger of the other side. That is likely, in fact, as many people are pointing out now, basically to push people over to supporting Trump. When you attack, if let's all gang up on those people, well, yeah, those people eventually, some of them are going to go to Trump. And what we recommend instead is what we call common humanity identity politics. And this is what's recommended by many of the great sages. This is what so we quote Paul E. Murray, a civil rights activist, an Episcopal minister, got a law degree from Yale in the 50s, I think it was. So she says, I intend to destroy segregation by positive and embracing methods. When my brothers try to draw a circle to exclude me, I shall draw a larger circle to include them. Where they speak out for the privileges of a puny group, I shall shout for the rights of all mankind. Now, that's identity politics. She's fighting against racism for civil rights for African Americans back in the 50s. She wrote that in the 40s, and then she's active in the 50s and 60s, I think. That's identity politics, but that's likely to succeed. It's consistent with basic social psychology, which is first draw a circle around people, emphasize common identity. What do we have in common? And then people are much more receptive to the claim that some people are being denied dignity or access.
With the advent of the internet and social media, in theory, the opportunity to draw the circle larger has never been greater to reach people from different cultures and nations. But since, I guess, around 2016, the perception of social media platforms like Facebook and Twitter have changed quite dramatically from being sort of the vanguard of the march towards ever more openness and progress to being viewed as almost the enemies of just about all progressive and decent values. And you and Greg also pile on. But surely it's a good thing that kids and young people can instantly access information that you and I would never have been able to get a hold of when we were growing up. So why is social media a potential threat rather than a boost for critical thinking and viewpoint diversity?
Right. So there are two big things that the internet does for us. One is so Google's mission, I think it was make the world information available. So that's fantastic. I mean, the fact that poor kids in Pakistan can teach themselves physics with courses from MIT, and they can, they know English already. So internet phase one and Google's mission and just making information available, I think that is overwhelmingly good. Obviously, anyone can get the plans for an atomic bomb. This could end very badly, but overall, increasing access to information, I think, is an extremely good thing to do. Phase two, Facebook's mission. Let's connect everybody to everybody. What could go wrong? Well, people are tribal, and very few people want to be connected to everybody. And people have a real need to display. This is the key thing that I think a lot of the tech people don't understand. So tech people tend to not know psychology and certainly not social psychology. They tend to be high systemizers. That is, they think very abstractly. They're good at thinking about systems, but not as good at thinking about people. And what I think has gone wrong is that I don't think they understood at Facebook and other sites how much individuals are immersed in an economy of prestige. What I mean is prestige is, some sociologists have written that prestige is like money. You know, you can get it, you can lose it. People want more of it and they'll do things to make more of it. So prestige, it's very clear for teenagers, especially who are not in a stable prestige structure, they have to actively gain prestige. And one of the ways you do that is by criticizing the right people, attacking the right people, being savage towards your group's enemies. And so many people have talked in the last couple of years about virtue signaling, the things we do. So you and I are talking right now. And, you know, if we were face to face over a beer, it would just be you and me. We both know that there's a large audience listening in, and we both care about what they think of us. But so far, I think we're not desperately signaling. We're not raising flags to show, oh, you know, like me because I hate person X, Y, and Z. But many internet conversations are like that. And this, I think, is internet phase two. Social media has forced young people to engage every day in interactions where some people are trying to get prestige by attacking whatever it is that their group hates. So, you know, on the left, of course, it's, you know, racism, sexism. And those are good things to be against, of course. But if daily interaction is done, you know, if you're talking about a movie or a restaurant you went to, and there's some people participating in the conversation who are looking for any excuse to attack you for racial insensitivity, then, you know, talking about the great Japanese dinner we had last night becomes like walking through a minefield. And if so many of your interactions are like that, and which is the case for many young people, you know, when I speak at colleges and I talk about call-out culture, and we talk about what it is, then I ask, do you have that here? All hands go up. Everybody, you know, everywhere, there's to some degree a call-out culture. And I ask, do you think this overall a good thing? And no hands go up. So I think Facebook and other social media platforms have created a prestige economy that people are trapped in. It's very hard to escape. Of course, they could just close all their social media accounts. And some teenagers do that. But I think overall, the effects might turn out to be bad.
You link both the shrinking tolerance of offensive ideas and the pervasiveness of the three untruths that we discussed with a deterioration in the mental health of what you call the iGen. What's the evidence of this trend? What are its causes? And why does it matter for the climate of academic freedom and free discourse on campus?
Yeah, these are really the central questions, I think, for your audience, if you're interested in questions of free speech. So the evidence that there's a mental health catastrophe among teenagers in the United States is now very strong. When Greg and I were writing our article in 2014 and early 2015, the evidence was weak. That is, back then, there were reports in the newspapers all the time about campus mental health centers saying they're overwhelmed. The line's out the door. We can't get therapy to all the students who are coming and asking for it. But those were really just anecdotes, and we didn't have the systematic data in early 2015. But now, 3 years later, there's a lot of data because the trend just started in 2012, 2013. So it's all reviewed in the book iGen, I-G-E-N, by Gene Twenge, T-W-E-N-G-E. So if you look at, and so we consulted the same data sets that she did. This is these are nationally representative surveys. Some are federal data. And if you break down the data by age group and gender, what you see is that the rates of depression and anxiety and suicide were fairly stable in the early 2000s, you know, from like 2000 to 2011 or so, fairly stable. And then suddenly, it's a very sharp elbow right around 2011. The boys' rate goes up, and this is not just for anxiety and depression, even for suicide. Boys are up 25% since the first decade. But the girls are up 70% in suicide, 70% increase if you take the average of the first 10 years of the century and compare it to the last two. So there's been a skyrocketing rate of anxiety, depression, and suicide, especially for girls. Boys too, but much bigger for girls. So this is a catastrophe. We've got to deal with this. Parents are alarmed. I talk to parents, and even if their kid isn't depressed or anxious, three of her friends are. So people are finally waking up that we have this crisis. What caused it? We don't know. There are two leading theories, or rather I should say, it's probably multiple factors, but the two biggest factors that Greg and I think are happening are, one is social media, because the timing is perfect. the iPhone comes out in 2007, but no teenagers have them in 2007. By 2010, most do. They have access to social media in their pockets. Facebook opens up to 13-year-olds in 2006. So we had a great recession. Things were bad economically in 2008, 2009, but they've gotten steadily better economically since then. Yet the rate of depression and anxiety has been going up and up and up. So it's not about economic anxiety. It's participation in social media. The evidence for that is not strong. What I mean is that Gene Twenge shows that there is a statistical relationship. Kids who spend more than 2 hours a day on social media are more likely to be anxious and depressed. The overall effect size is not large because the measures are rather crude. We just don't know how big the effect is. But Twenge does show that there is a relationship which appears to be causal. Now, it's all based on correlational data. But if you look at time lag and you look at sort of dose response, you can make some somewhat reliable causal extractions from correlational data of that sort. Obviously not conclusive, but suggested. At any rate, so social media is a big aspect of it, and it makes sense that it affects girls a lot more than boys, because boys' aggression is generally physical, and social media doesn't change it. Girls' aggression, we've known for decades, is more relational. Girls, when they're aggressive to each other, it's by damaging each other's relationships. And the social media makes that so easy to do 24 hours a day, even on weekends.
Like shaming your friends or...
Shaming, starting rumors, spreading rumors, making forged photographs that humiliate them. I think that kind of bullying is one of the reasons that girls suicide and self-harm, that girls are cutting themselves at much higher rates than they did before social media. So that's one is social media. The other big cause of it, which will really affect both sexes, is the rapid decline in free play. So for all of history, as far as we know, if you look at hunter-gatherers too, kids play with each other and they play in mixed age groups and they practice the skills they'll need in adulthood. They'll practice hunting. They'll play, tag is a universal game. You try to be a predator and you try to avoid predators. So kids play. But what we did in the 90s was we got it in our heads that if we ever let our kids outside without supervision, they may be abducted. I don't know if any other country went in for this insanity, but there's hardly any kidnapping of kids in America. There never has been. But beginning in the 80s, the very few cases of it began to get enormous media attention because of cable TV shows. So Americans freaked out in the 80s and 90s. They put photos of missing kids on milk cartons and electricity bills and pizza boxes. We totally freaked out. And by the 90s, the norm had developed that if your kids are outside unsupervised, like, an 8, 9, 10-year-old kid, if those siblings go play in a park, they could be abducted. Now, we don't hear about parental arrests until the early 2000s. Now they happen, I don't know how often, but they do happen that parents are arrested multiple times a year. These stories also get a lot of play. The point is that you talk to kids now, and I do, I talk to teenagers now, I say, at what age were you able to just go out to a park with your friends or go play in the woods? And they say, maybe 14, 15, 13. Nobody says 8 or 9. Now, in some parts of the country, I'm sure it is. But anyone older than 40, we all talk like, oh my God, when we were kids, we'd ride our bicycles, we'd get in rock fights, we'd limp back home. The parents didn't know where we were. Now that turns out, of course there were more injuries, but because humans are anti-fragile, when you get in trouble as a kid, you get in a scrape and you get yourself out of it, you grow, you get stronger. And if you don't have such adventures, if you don't have a lot of practice, thousands of hours of practice of independence and facing threats on your own, when you go off to college, you're not ready for it. And so we think that this is the other big issue. And that's why the subtitle of our book is How Good Intentions and Bad Ideas Are Setting Up a Generation for Failure. We've been so focused on protecting our kids and preparing them academically for college that I think we have set them back socially. We've set them back on the main task, which is learn how to live independently.
Okay, so you've argued now that in terms of free speech, things are getting worse at American universities, at least for the iGen. But as I mentioned, this is a podcast on the history of free speech. And as the listeners of this podcast know all too well, Hostility to ideas is nothing new. So even though the phenomenon you've highlighted might increase the tendency of tribalism and so on, it certainly wasn't paranoid parenting and social media that created them. And so this is where I'd like to enter the time machine and travel back in time so that we might try and connect present challenges to free speech with old ones.
All right.
And this is also where I'd love to get into The Righteous Mind, which has been very helpful for me as a lawyer thinking about some of these issues from a different perspective. You argue for the existence of five innate moral foundations, including loyalty, betrayal, care, harm, authority, subversion, and sanctity, degradation. And as I mentioned, I found them really useful as an analytical tool when comparing repression of thought and ideas from Socrates to the Inquisition and even modern hate speech laws. Could you expand on how these moral foundations can challenge the ideal of free speech and perhaps getting back to the issue of tribalism first and foremost?
Yes. No, gladly. I think that's right on the money. The fifth foundation you forgot to mention, I think, was fairness cheating. Something I've seen a lot of. So let me start at the beginning. In my book, The Righteous Mind, it's all about the puzzle of how did we get morality? Humans are really different from any other species, even chimpanzees. There are some hints that maybe they have some social norms that they might enforce, but it's mostly just a few anecdotes. Humans are really intense about this. If you put kids together, they'll quickly develop norms, and then they'll hold each other accountable, or they'll make up rules. How do we do this? And I looked especially at religion as a kind of a crucial part of our evolution. We evolved to be religious. There's a wonderful book called Dancing in the Streets by Barbara Ehrenreich. She talks about how when the European explorers first went out around the world, they found that wherever they went, people would dress in special dress, put paint of some sort on their bodies, and dance to rhythmic music, often around a campfire. That there's a kind of a kind of ritual, there's a kind of a normal default human religiosity. And we in the West and the East, certain large, and Central America, certain large-scale religions were invented, but those were imposed over the top of our small-scale kind of tribal animist nature. We were very good at binding together and worshiping something in common, and then we trust each other more. And so that's always there. And some forms of social arrangement play that up. We get more tribal in that way. Others tone it down. I think the genius of liberal democracy and English norms of governance, and separation of church and state, all these things, is to turn it down. When people focus their attentions on trade, on making money, that tends to reduce their tribal loyalties. But it can pop back up quickly, as we saw, for example, in the Red Scares in the United States. So on the right, you'd have desires to purge people if they had associations with communism. All of these things they show blasphemy, blasphemy laws, sacrilege. There are certain religious phenomena that keep coming up even in non-religious contexts. And so what's so striking to me about what's happened on university campuses since 2015 or so is the emergence of this more religious way of being. I want to make clear, this is not a statement about most students. Most students, even if you go to schools like Brown or Amherst or Berkeley or UCLA, Middlebury, the places that have had these big blowups, it's not that most students are somehow against free speech. It's that there's a new dynamic brought in by a subset of students that have sacred values and that see certain kinds of speech as blasphemous or sacrilege. And so that's especially clear at Middlebury. So Middlebury, it's a very progressive school in Vermont. And when Charles Murray came to speak in March of 2017, when he came to speak about social class, he wasn't going to talk about race. He was going to talk about his book on social class, which was the biggest issue of the time. Why had the white working class left the Democratic Party and rallied so heavily for Trump? This is one of the most important issues that Middlebury students could have learned about. Charles Murray was going to speak about that. But because he had written the book, The Bell Curve, back in 1994, which did say that he thought that race differences resulted both from environmental and genetic causes, because he said that, now you can debate that, many did, in the 90s, but some people treated it as blasphemy or sacrilege. And that means he's barred for life. He is taboo. He cannot be associated with. And so if your listeners look at those videos, if you just Google Charles Murray Middlebury protest, you can see what happened when he came to speak. He gets up on stage, and hundreds of students had come to that auditorium to shut him down. The instant he starts speaking, they turn their back on him and they start chanting. And if you watch the way they chant rhythmically and sway and sing, it's a revival meeting. It's a unification of a politically and morally passionate group fighting what they see as true evil. But it has all the hallmarks of a religious ceremony. So that's where I think the link to free speech comes in. Free speech is great in principle, but as soon as some people interpret someone else's speech as blasphemy or sacrilege, then they're going to want to shut it down forcefully.
I think there are a number of examples that, in my research for the podcast, really brings this to the fore. For instance, when it comes to the Sanctity Degradation Foundation that you mentioned, and is shaped by the psychology of disgust and contamination, that might have been motivating the Middlebury students. But there are some clear parallels to early times. Say, the 6th century emperor Justinian actually banned pagans from teaching as they were, in his word, affected by disease and could turn Orthodox Christians away from the true and pure faith. And John Calvin defended the burning of the heretic Servetus because impure and petulant tongues should not be allowed to lacerate the sacred name of God. So I don't think there are any students today who'd like to physically burn their opponents. But are there some similarities between these modern secular and progressive academic censors and these old notorious examples of persecution and inquisition?
Yes, I do believe so. So I think I say somewhere in the righteous mind, if you know what a group holds sacred, or follow the sacredness, around it, you'll find a ring of motivated ignorance. So if you know what a group holds sacred, you'll see how they respond to blasphemy. And it's never to engage in debate or to argue against it. It's generally banishment or death by fire. Fire, so for some reason, fire is uniquely satisfying as a purifying agent.
Yeah.
Now, as you say, so let me make clear, the student protests of the last 3 years have been almost entirely peaceful. There have been a few episodes of violence, but they're very rare. We're not back in the witch burning days. But the psychology of it is very, very similar. And that's what chapter five of our book is about, is that if you understand the phenomenology and psychology of witch hunts from Salem through the McCarthy era, you can see a lot of those same dynamics today. And yes, the Sanctity Foundation is the key. The idea that we are a community, worship something in common, some person, some principle, some place. And if sacrilege or blasphemy were to have contact, it will degrade, pollute, poison. Therefore, it must be banned. And if we can't ban it, we have to burn it out. And so there's a very revealing moment in the Charles Murray video where the president or a dean is telling the students, okay, we have arranged for to move the talk. And some of the students shout out, off campus, off campus. And I think the dean says, to a different room. And they moan, they go like, oh, no, no. Because the point is not that he should not speak anywhere. It's that he must not speak within the grounds of our campus, because that would be to despoil and pollute it. So I think the idea that the entire grounds of the campus must be pure with regard to these things, that is religious. And that is very antithetical to what many of us think of as the purpose of a university, is bringing people together who, not everybody, we don't want everybody on campus, but we want people who have done research and have something to say based on research, even if we don't like it. We think that there should be room for divergent ideas. We've thought that ever since Socrates.
Exactly. And that's a very good example of someone who, again, fell afoul of these communal values of blaspheming and both transgressing his fellow Athenian sense of loyalty and sanctity by rejecting the ideals of democracy and by questioning the religious ideas that bound the Athenian polis together.
That's right. I think that's why we need universities. Because if you go down to the public square and you say such things, somebody's going to take offense. Somebody's going to apply a religious frame of mind and think that their children are at risk. So that's why I think we need universities. I think the old ideal of an ivory tower, I don't know at what point that came into the lexicon of universities, but the idea of a place removed that has different norms, not the norms of the public square, I think is very, very important, because what we're trying to do on campus is in some ways unnatural. It's not about winning and losing. It's about putting people together in the right way so that they challenge each other, expose each other to ideas they otherwise wouldn't find, and come out stronger and smarter, better able to think in nuanced ways. And it's very hard to do that in the public square, where it's all about virtue signaling, asserting power, and fighting your enemies.
One of the really important ideas that you and Greg challenge is that words constitute violence. I think there was a Yale study that showed that 80% of college students agreed with the notion that words can be a form of violence. You argue that it's due to concept creep, where the term violence is being inflated to encompass mere psychological slights or harms. I found there's actually a long tradition of this. For instance, according to several accounts of the Prophet Muhammad, he had poets, including women, killed for slandering him and his new religion. None other than Thomas Hobbes argued that the mere act of disagreement is offensive, and that words can be a crime, and consequently people could be put to the sword for saying stuff that might provoke violence. So can we again fit the idea that words constitute a form of violence into one of your basic human moral foundations?
No, now wait a second. You gave me examples where words are considered a crime. I certainly agree with that. Words can be a crime. Slander, libel. Words can be painful. Words can harm. There's no disagreement on that. Mm. The question is whether to say, if person A said something and I felt pain, was that violence? Did that person commit violence? And Greg and I think that this is a terrible line to cross. Violence has a very clear meaning. We all understand what it means when we say, hey, we should stop locking up nonviolent offenders. We all know what that means. There are certain bright lines that people will cross for rhetorical advantage, and that's what's going on here. When people say they think hate speech is violence, or they think that the words are, you know, that words that make people feel marginalized are violence, they're blurring a line which is very, very dangerous, because you might think that you can use it to make your opponents suddenly liable to the full force of the law, because we're all very strongly against violence. But then the other side's going to do it too. If we blur the line between harm, because of course words can be harmful, if we say that all harm to me and my friends is violence, it's first of all rather incoherent, and secondly, it just exposes us all to chaos and inflated claims. The state has a monopoly on violence, and so if I can succeed in painting my opponent's words as violence, well then I get to call in the state to shut them up. But you know what? As soon as the other side is in power, they're going to do the same to me. And this is why Musa Al-Gharbi, our communications director at Heterodox Academy, he's been saying this for a while. He and I have a piece in The Atlantic on how ultimately free speech benefits minorities, and the restrictions on speech, even if in the short run you think you might get some advantage, in the long run it tends to come back and hurt those who are least powerful.
My last question. In the righteous mind, you argue that our brains are pre-wired, not hardwired. So even though we might have evolved in a way that pushes us towards tribalism and makes free speech difficult, you and Greg suggest a number of concrete steps to overcome the great untruths and to sort of foster viewpoint diversity and academic free speech. So how do we overcome the human urge to reenact the Inquisition?
So people are very flexible. Kids are very good at what's called code switching. They know that there's certain ways of speaking. Like I just heard, you know, my kids, my wife and I heard our kids cursing. They didn't know that we were listening in at the door of a hotel room just before we came back. We heard them cursing. They were 7 and 12 at the time. And you know, they know how to speak in certain contexts and how not to speak. So people are very good at behaving appropriately in the context. And if the message when students come to campus is, what we're doing here is exactly like what we do everywhere else. It's all about fighting evil. It's fighting for justice. What we're doing here is no different from every place else, and all the same rules apply. Go at it. then you're going to have constant conflict and virtue signaling and shaming and call out. But if leadership says instead, we are all immersed in a hyper-moralized, hyper-polarized, very difficult situation, what we're trying to do here is something very different, and it's going to be hard. It's going to be really hard. And to do it, we've got to give each other the benefit of the doubt. We have to try to be less offensive, and we have to try to take less offense. We are a community. And if you focus those first weeks on community building, on enhancing the sense of shared identity, and making clear, here's what we do. Here are the norms we need. Here's the norms we have. Here is why free speech is so important. Of course, that doesn't mean you can say anything you want. You know, if you're yelling obscenities at someone, there will be social consequences. But we have a basic rule here that if somebody is speaking about an idea, you don't shut them down, you don't shut them up. And if you do, you might be expelled. If leadership makes the norms clear, and if you try to talk about both the diversity and inclusion issues and the free speech issues all at the same time, then I think it can work. I think people are hungry for better forms of connection. When students go to college, I think they want an active intellectual life. They want discussion and debate. So I think the will is there very, very widely. What's lacking has been leadership and clear norm setting. And that's something that Greg and I hope that our book will do, that it'll give leaders, campus leaders, the vocabulary to set much more effective norms. And so, you know, we think that universities they have the tools to improve themselves. We have a lot of research on how to make diversity work, and we think that we can make viewpoint diversity work.
Thank you so much for speaking to me today. It's been a real pleasure and indeed a privilege.
Well, thanks so much, Jacob. My pleasure too.